From KPFK Pacifica Radio, this is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this program on Free Speech TV and listen to it on Pacifica radio stations and affiliates nationwide. The United States Supreme Court has touched just about every aspect of Americans' lives. Right now, justices are hearing arguments and cases concerning the rights of LGBTQ Americans to have a discrimination-free workplace. Although the court is meant to uphold the rights of individuals under the Constitution, historically the body has, on numerous occasions, violated its own principles. In recent years, the court's justices have taken it upon themselves to empower corporations to such an extent that our entire political system has been perverted to preserve and expand the power of corporate profiteers at the expense of people and the planet. How did we get here? And what can be done about it? Joining me to answer that question is Tom Hartman, renowned progressive radio talk show host, New York Times bestselling author of 24 books, including The Hidden History of Guns and the Second Amendment. And he joins me to discuss his latest book, The Hidden History of the Supreme Court and the Betrayal of America. Welcome back to the show, Tom.
Thank you, Sonali. It's great to be here with you.
So we had talked to you last time about your book about the Second Amendment. Here you are writing a history about the Supreme Court. But for those who don't really pay attention to the details of the role that the court plays in our political system, can you give us that brief history lesson about what it was that the Constitution's framers intended in the role, in seeing the role of this court with nine justices making these very important decisions about our lives?
Yeah. Well, the ultimate issue is, you know, do we want a constitutional monarchy, which is essentially what we have with the Supreme Court exercising judicial review as rigorously as it does, or do we want a constitutional democracy, a democratic republic? The founders envisioned the Supreme Court as having two basic purposes. The first was to be the primary court where disputes between the states and between the federal government and the states would be adjudicated, and among other United States and other countries and some maritime law. And then, but the principal job of the court, probably 95%, 99% of what the court does, is being the court of last appeals. Somebody sues somebody else and they win, and then that person appeals it, and then they win, and then the other person appeals it, and it goes back and forth. There's got to be a place where the buck stops, and that's the Supreme Court. But starting in 1803, the court took onto itself, over the loud objections of President Jefferson at the time, the right to not only decide who wins and loses a case, but also to decide whether the laws passed by Congress and signed by the president match the court's understanding of the Constitution. And that's when, you know, according to Jefferson and many of the founders and framers, that was when we slid out of being a democratic republic and into being a constitutional monarchy. It so burned the fingers of the court, of John Marshall, the Chief Justice, the blowback to that case, that Marbury versus Madison case, that he never did it again. And he was on the bench longer than any other Chief Justice. The second time was Dred Scott in 1856, when Chief Justice Roger Twaney thought he would solve once and for all the slavery problem. So basically, the court acted as the court of final appeals throughout the first 80 or 90 or 100 years of American history. But in the 1880s, as at least three of the justices on the court were being bribed by Jay Gould and the railroad billionaires, the court started striking down laws and changing laws and reinterpreting laws according to what they said the Constitution meant. And now that's almost all that the court does. It's really not the way it was envisioned.
Now, you mentioned judicial review. What exactly is that?
Judicial review is the ability of a court to say, we are going to look at this law and determine whether it comports with the Constitution or not. The rationale for that that John Marshall laid out in the 1803 Marbury case was that the Constitution itself says that it is the supreme law of the land. So it is the law. And somebody has to decide what the Constitution means, you know, if somebody passes a law that's unconstitutional. But, you know, this is how the court was sold. This is from Federalist Number 81 by Alexander Hamilton. There is not a syllable in the Constitution under consideration which directly empowers the national courts to construe the laws according to the spirit of the Constitution, or which gives them any greater latitude in this respect than may be claimed by the courts of every state. So, you know, it was not it was not the way the court was sold. And it's something that we really need to have a conversation about in this country. People say, for example, well, what if Congress passed a law saying that if you criticize the president, you go to jail? It's an obvious violation of the First Amendment. And my response is Congress did pass that law in 1798, the Alien Sedition Act. It was the break between President Adams and Vice President Jefferson. They didn't talk to each other for 2 years after that. And the first thing Adams did was throw Ben Franklin's grandson in jail for calling him balding and querulous, in his paper, The Aurora. But that was solved not by the Supreme Court. That was solved by the election of 1800. And that was what Jefferson said when George Mason sent him a letter saying, well, if the Supreme Court doesn't have the power to decide what the Constitution says, who does? And Jefferson said, the people themselves. This is why Congress is, why the House of Representatives, which is where all power begins, whether it's taxing, spending, or war, why the House of Representatives is entirely 100% reelected every 2 years.
So currently we are essentially told that the Supreme Court is part of that system of checks and balances between the various branches of government. And when the congressional branch or the executive branch gets too powerful or abuses its power too much, the Supreme Court is there to step in. Is that a myth?
No, if there was a dispute between those two branches, as we're starting to see right now in this impeachment hearing, then the court plays a role in that dispute. They're an arbiter in that dispute. That's a different thing from judicial review, where the court, literally strikes down laws or even manufactures laws, writes laws, comes up with opinions that where they have invented doctrines. So what we have now, I remember after Obamacare was passed, everybody was like holding their breath, is the court going to strike it down? The founders and framers, I think, would be rolling over in their graves at something like that. What we have now is a constitutional monarchy where the monarchs are 9 unelected people with lifetime positions on the Supreme Court who have final say over literally everything. And we really need to have a conversation in this country about whether that's what we want.
So let's talk about how it is that the role that the court has played in a very critical aspect of our American political system, which is that today we have a situation where corporations are considered people and money is considered free speech, a concept that has ended up, allowing the wealthy to foist their views, their policies, their politics on the entire country. What role did the Supreme Court play in making that happen?
Well, these are both examples of judicial review. In the case of corporations becoming persons, the court actually didn't rule in 1886 in Santa Clara County versus Southern Pacific Railroad that corporations are persons. But John Chandler Bancroft Davis, the clerk of the court, wrote it into the headnotes that Morrison Remick Waite, the Chief Justice, had said that in the court. But the court started referring to that headnote, which has no legal status. And as soon as they quoted it, suddenly it did have legal status. So that's where we got that from, was, the court, quote, interpreting the 14th Amendment, part of the Constitution. And then in 1976, for the first time in the history of the United States, money had always been viewed as a commodity that could be regulated. In fact, you could make an argument that most of the Constitution is about property rights, unless the regulation of money in its various forms or things that can be bought with money. But in 1976, in the Buckley versus Vallejo case, heavily influenced by Lewis Powell, who'd just been on the court for 5 years at that point, the author of the Powell memo, the court ruled that if a billionaire wants to own a politician or change public opinion, with regard to things like ballot initiatives, that's just fine. That's considered free speech. Money is speech. And then they doubled down on that 2 years later in the First National Bank versus Frank Bilotti decision, where they said that this logic extends to corporations as well. And then they tripled down on it in October of 2010 with the Citizens United decision. No legislature of any state and no federal legislature has ever said money is speech and corporations are people. In fact, they have repeatedly said the opposite. No president or candidate for president has ever said that, other than Mitt Romney in who knows how serious, well, whatever, but has, you know, no sitting president has ever said that. The corporations are people and money is speech. This was entirely invented by the Supreme Court. And it points out the danger of having essentially the Supreme Court as the monarchs in a constitutional monarchy, rather than having a true democracy.
And so you mentioned very briefly Lewis Powell and the Powell memo. This is something that is the basis of so much of the sort of corporate oligarchy that we're seeing played out in the country today, the supremacy of quote unquote free enterprise. And didn't his memo essentially give wind to the Koch brothers and their stranglehold over American politics?
Yes, during the early years of the Industrial Revolution, the 1870s, 80s, 90s, as the steel oligarchs, the oil oligarchs, and the rail oligarchs rose up, they began to politicize the court and Congress, for that matter. And there was a significant backlash to that, and that was Teddy Roosevelt's administration. And, you know, the trust busters and the passage of the Tillman Act in 1907 that made it a federal felony for a corporation to give money to politicians for federal office. And so basically from that era, from the 1900s, right up until the 1960s and 70s, corporations, you know, they'd gotten their fingers burned and they just stayed out of politics. And in 1971, Lewis Powell wrote this memo in which he pointed out that Ralph Nader and Rachel Carson, and he named them the memo, had kicked off a consumer movement and an environmental movement, respectively, that were placing the profits of corporations at risk, and that big corporations and wealthy individuals needed to join forces and take over our courts, take over our legislatures, take over our states, take over our schools, take over our colleges, take over our media. And that led to the creation of the Heritage Foundation and the Cato Institute and the Competitive Enterprise Institute and all these other right-wing organizations. It led to the rise of the right-wing media barons. And of course, it led to the Federalist Society, which is right now actively packing our federal court system. Of course, Powell being on the court brought us Buckley. And in fact, Lewis Powell authored the decision 2 years later in First National Bank versus Bilotti.
In your book, you point out that there are so many issues that majorities of Americans support, such as taxing the ultra wealthy, such as reproductive rights for women, et cetera. And yet we don't have some of these very hugely popular policies in place. How much of a role has the Supreme Court played in essentially preventing that democratic exercise of power?
It's huge. It's absolutely huge, because in 76 and 78, by saying that billionaires and corporations can own politicians on a virtually unlimited basis, and then in 2010 with Citizens United making it practical, you know, for all practical purposes, an unlimited basis, and then the McCutcheon decision 3 years later, which, you know, originally there was a limit to the number of politicians an individual billionaire could own, and they said, no, there's not a limit. You can, you know, it's not 130 like it used to be. It's whatever you want. What these decisions have done is they have taken the entire political process out of the hands of voters and average Americans and put them into the hands of a small group of elite billionaires and big corporations. Gillens and Page at Columbia University did a study that was published back in, I think, 2015, maybe 2014, in which they found that nowadays, unlike the 1950s, in the 1950s and 60s and 1970s, and look at the accomplishments of the Great Society of Lyndon Johnson, for example, creating Medicare and Medicaid and all these other things. During that era, what was generally politically popular among the majority of people was what got made into law. But now, today, the probabilities of what the bottom 90% of Americans economically want being made into law is absolutely equivalent to random chance. It's the equivalent of noise, just, you know, mathematical noise in the system. Whereas the desires of the top 5% are frequently more, you know, well over half of the time, and when you get into the top 1%, well over 2/3 of the time enacted into law. So, you know, we have a system that has been badly corrupted by money, and that was brought to you exclusively by the Supreme Court In fact, when they did that in Buckley in 76, they struck down several of the laws that just the year before had been passed by Congress in the wake of the Nixon bribery scandals to get money out of politics, to clean the whole thing up.
So today we have a court that is deeply polarized and, you know, really is extremely partisan. We've seen so much, you know, depending upon who is nominating a Supreme Court justice to the court, just those decisions are deeply political and deeply partisan. Is that new? Is that a new trend in the Supreme Court? Or has the Supreme Court essentially always been and nominating justices, has that practice always been a partisan issue depending upon the political party allegiance of the president making the nominations?
It has, to a certain extent, throughout its history, been a political agency. You know, the times have been different and the issues have been different, but the court from its founding has been basically an instrument that protected wealth and privilege, aggressively protected wealth and privilege, and continues to be so. And this is where I think we need to democratize the court. And there's a number of ways to deal with this court becoming so ideological and so, you know, hardcore right-wing crazed as a result of Mitch McConnell basically violating his oath of office and not respecting the Constitution, you know, refusing to allow Obama's nominees on the court for several years, including Merrick Garland. And we could look at what Franklin Roosevelt nearly did in 37, court packing, what actually was done by Congress when Andrew Johnson became president. They cut the size of the court from 10 people down to 6 so that Andrew Johnson would not be able to put anybody on the court. And then right after Johnson got out of office and U.S. Grant was president, they raised it back up to 9, which is where it is now. That could be done. Article 3, Section 2 of the Constitution says that Congress can define exceptions to things that the court can rule on. So it is possible that Congress could pass a law saying money is no longer speech and corporations are no longer persons. It's called court stripping or judicial court stripping generally. It's happened in states a few times. There has been legislation that has had provisions saying that the Supreme Court may not review the laws, but they've been non-controversial laws. If that were to happen, what I just described, it would create a constitutional crisis. I mean, it would be open war between the Congress and the Supreme Court. But Article 3, Section 2 of the Constitution is quite explicit. The Supreme Court shall operate under exceptions and regulations defined by Congress. That's exactly what it says, and I can't see how it can be interpreted to mean anything else.
Right now, we have a situation where the Supreme Court may play a role in an impeachment inquiry. We have an impeachment inquiry underway where the House of Representatives is where such inquiries or articles begin. And then if it does pass the House, it goes to the Senate for a trial presided over by the Chief Justice of that court, in this case, John Roberts. What do you hope, given where the court is today, the role that the court will play in what is definitely going to be a history-making chapter in America?
Yeah, assuming that it gets to the Senate and that Mitch McConnell allows there to be a trial, which I think are both looking like better than 50% right now. John Roberts was William Rehnquist's clerk during the impeachment of Bill Clinton. So he's familiar with the process. And Rehnquist did a pretty good job of staying out of the way, basically just being the judge. Where it's going to get interesting, and this did not happen in the case of the Clinton impeachment, and it never got to the Senate, so there wasn't a discussion about it with the Nixon impeachment hearings. And this didn't happen with the impeachment of Andrew Johnson either. What's going to be interesting is if the Trump administration continues to stonewall Congress. They're doing it right now to the House of Representatives. The House may not have, at the end of the day, the power to force them to produce witnesses or papers or whatever, even under subpoena and even with contempt citations. But when it gets to the Senate, that's an actual trial. And in a trial, you can be ordered to produce evidence and you may not refuse that order. And that's going to be a real crisis for John Roberts if the Trump administration continues to stonewall and all this stuff.
Now, I want to look a little bit more broadly around the Supreme Court, and especially a really important issue right about in your book, The Hidden History of the Supreme Court and the Betrayal of America, which is that while we are involved in the political circus that is playing out in Washington, D.C., the planet, or I should say the species, our species, is in an existential crisis. We are seeing the warming of the planet in a very, very serious way. And you point out in your book, of course, that because corporations have used the Citizens United decision to flood our system with money, it essentially, we are beholden, our system is beholden to fossil fuel interests. How critically important is the Supreme Court when it comes to the issue of climate change? There are cases right now before the Supreme Court on the climate, right?
Well, and there's one particularly big case, the Giuliani case, which is working its way in the direction of the Supreme Court. I believe it's still before the Ninth Circuit right now. And the problem that we have, Sonali, is that at the time that the Constitution was written in 1787, the hot new things that, you know, had just kind of come about in the last arguably 200 years prior to that, from, you know, the 1630s when Thomas Hobbes wrote Leviathan, to the 1680s when John Locke wrote Second Treatise on Government. The hot new things were human rights, which we saw built into the Bill of Rights in our Constitution, and property rights, which is probably 80% of the Constitution. And the idea that individual commoners, or at least men, at least white men, could own property was a relatively new thing, you know, after 1,000 years of feudal history in Europe, or more than that even. So the Constitution speaks eloquently to those two issues. But the idea that the environment was important, or even should have rights, you know, living things other than human beings should have rights, or even systems, living systems, rivers and air and things like that should have rights, was pretty much unimaginable at that time. I mean, the cities would dump their waste into rivers and it just seemed to vanish. It seemed like the world was limitless. The resources were limitless. And now we're confronted with a planet that is overcrowded by people, overpoisoned by the products of us. We're consuming more than 50% of the world's fresh water. We're consuming more than 50% of the world's photosynthesis, the products of photosynthesis, leaving all these other species to compete for the dregs at the same time that we're poisoning them. And there's not really any place in the Constitution that addresses this. It really needs to be done at the level of a legislature. Although in a constitutional monarchy, I suppose the monarchs could decide something. They could literally, like they created out of thin air the doctrine of corporate personhood, the Supreme Court did, or they created out of thin air the doctrine that money is the same thing as free speech in the First Amendment. They could create a doctrine, I suppose, that nature has rights. I'd frankly rather see it be done legislatively, though.
Right. And of course, if they were to do that, they would be betraying their allegiance to corporate America, which unfortunately is highly unlikely. Finally, Tom, you've written two hidden history books now, the first one on the Second Amendment, this one on the Supreme Court. What's next? Are you going to continue the series?
Yes, there's one coming out in the spring. It's the hidden history of the war on voting, who stole your vote and how to get it back. That's already available for pre-order and it's out there. It will be shipping in March of next year. And then the one that will be coming out next fall, which I'm still writing, I've got a deadline at the end of this month here to finish it, we don't have a fully formed title, but it's going to be some variation on the hidden history of monopoly and how monopoly has destroyed both capitalism and democracy.
Wow. Well, looking forward to it, Tom. Such a pleasure to have you on. Thanks as always for joining us. Hope to have you back with your next books.
Thank you, Sonali. It's great being on your program. Thank you so much.
Tom Hartmann is a renowned progressive radio talk show host, a New York Times bestselling author of 24 books, including The Hidden History of Guns and the Second Amendment. And we've been discussing his latest book, The Hidden History of the Supreme Court and the Betrayal of America. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com, where you can sign up for our daily newsletter, subscribe to our video channel on Vimeo, and find our audio podcast on iTunes and Spotify.